Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me today right now is Chris Van Arsdale. He's the Houghton County Emergency Management Coordinator. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's a good opportunity for us to talk about different things the public should be, you know, aware of, or things that could happen and how they could be prepared here in Houghton County. We certainly are no stranger to, you know, whether they're weather problems or problems with the bridge or other things that could come up. And in the middle of one of those emergencies is not a good time to ask, well, I wonder what I should be doing to be prepared for this. So we're going to try to stay ahead of that. So.
Yes, indeed.
So tell me a little bit about the office that you work for and your function.
Sure. So the Office of Emergency Measures works, we actually work for both Houghton and Keweenaw County. And we have kind of a two big pieces to that job. One is the preparedness component, where we try and identify what are the most likely emergencies we would have in this area, and what are the things we can do to be prepared for those. So what is the plan should those happen, in terms of who's going to respond, what their jobs are going to be when they get on scene. So that's part of it. We also look at ways of prevention, obviously. Are there things we can do to avoid some of these things from happening? And then we also look at mitigation. So if there are things we can't avoid the weather very well, what can we do to minimize the impact should something happen? So that's kind of the mitigation component. And then the response component, does everybody know what the plan is, all the first responders, how are we going to communicate, that type of thing. So that's kind of the preparedness end of it. And then the flip side is, once an event happens, the office, we do coordination between agencies. So it's kind of a logistical component of a response. So you've got a large fire, and the fire chief says, where are we going to get 5 more tankers to shuttle water? So, you know, my office's job is to have that list and be able to get on the phone and make those contacts and help whoever the responders are on scene with kind of those logistical components that not that they can't do them on their own. Most of the time they do. But when an incident gets to a certain size, it's easier to have someone offsite do some of those things. So the incident commander can deal right with the incident at hand.
Now, when it comes to preparedness, now you've mentioned firefighters and I'm sure local police departments coming into that. What are there some agencies maybe besides, you know, those two that would pop immediately to mind like that you would be working with and to prepare?
Yeah, so we work with certainly all the law enforcement agencies in both counties, the fire departments, and then we deal with a lot of the first responders, the EMS agency or the ambulance companies. We also coordinate a lot with other counties because we all have limited resources. So we work a lot with Berga and with Onondaga counties, and the agencies in those counties as well. We work with the Forest Service and the DNR, search and rescue, are just some of them. So quite a few agencies, a lot of different people. You know, there are about 24 fire departments in both counties, and, you know, another, I think, 10 or 12 first responding agencies, in terms of medical first responders and ambulance company and hospitals and long-term care facilities. All those people play a role in our response. Sometimes they're part of the response efforts, and sometimes they're just affected by an incident. So a lot of moving parts.
Do you focus only on Houghton County, or does Keweenaw County, Onondaga, and Berga have their own, you know, emergency manager?
Onondaga and Berga have their own, and I do both Houghton and Keweenaw.
Oh, okay. And what about funding? Is it all supported through the county?
There's actually a grant program that it's a federal grant administered by the state that pays for a portion of that, and the counties then pay for the rest of it.
So now we got an idea a little bit about how your office works. Let's talk about preparedness. What type of incidents do you prepare for?
So we prepare for all sorts of incidents. We try and come up with a list. We use a process called THIRA, which is the Threat Hazard Identification and Risk Assessment. And we start with that and kind of say, what are the possible scenarios of things that could happen? So in this area, we look at things like a severe storm or a loss of utilities, possibly a wildfire, some kind of terrorist activity are kind of the top of that list. Severe flooding would be another one. So that's kind of where we start. And then we say, all right, if we had a severe winter storm, what are the things that we want to accomplish in, say, the first 24 or 48 hours? And then we look at what equipment do we need, what responders do we need, basically what resources to respond to that. And then we do an analysis of what we have and then say, okay, well, here are the gaps in our response, and then we work towards trying to fill in those gaps. So looking for grant money, maybe provide training for local first responders that we already have to try and fill in those holes. So it's kind of the process behind it and how we identify them. We do the best we can with the information we have. There are some things that are hard to plan around. A good example is like the natural gas outage they had in Lawrence this past December. A lot of our things we think about, losing power is not uncommon. Losing phone service even might not be uncommon. Losing natural gas isn't one we usually think about. And so, you have a generator that's a backup system for your power, but did you... think about that. Is your generator natural gas? What are you going to do if there's no natural gas and it's cold? So things like that do pop up. And so we do try and kind of watch other areas as well. What are some scenarios that have happened or some incidents that have happened in other areas? And then look at what we have here and say, could that happen here? Down there it was a gentleman who fell asleep, went off the road, and hit a natural gas line. How exposed are the other ones in the area? So that was definitely something we went back and looked at immediately after that and said, are we in danger of that same thing happening in this area? And if it happens, what is our plan? And so I know that's been a topic of discussion certainly this spring as to what would we do in that kind of scenario. So,
what about something that doesn't sound like so much of an emergency as it is a major inconvenience that could lead to an emergency, like we had an animal chew through some cell phone lines or something a few years ago. I mean, when you lose some communication, cell phone service or landline service was suddenly unavailable, would that fire your center into or your office into action?
Yep. A lot of those things, it varies on the severity. It's kind of a gray area. A lot of it is, the question is, what is the threshold where we get involved? And really, it's whenever the on-scene commander, called the incident commander, thinks that he or she needs additional support, they can call at any time. So it can be something that doesn't seem like a real big event at the time, but maybe they expect it to grow faster. It could just be something that they're not familiar with and need a resource that they don't know about. So that could be an area also. So there's not an actual line in the sand where we cross, but it really varies on every scenario. It could be something like you said, if we lose, say, 911 service. There's a backup for that. But what happens if that gets overwhelmed? There is a plan for an extended power outage. But what happens if we don't have power and we don't have natural gas? So that kind of thing is always changing, and it becomes a question of where are your priorities. You can only focus on so many tasks at one time. And you also don't want to pigeonhole yourself. You don't want to have a plan so detailed that, one little thing is different from what you thought it was going to be and your plan won't work anymore. So it's a tough balancing act going back and forth. So,
the last time I saw you was at the Houghton County Board of Commissioners meeting, and you were talking about, you're addressing the emergency plan if anything was to happen to the bridge, and you mentioned about all the different variables of what could, come into effect because, unfortunately, a bridge outing won't go according to plan.
That is correct, yes. Of all the scenarios we deal with, that probably is one of the most difficult ones at the moment. We've got about 25,000 people on that side, or someone actually corrected me the other day and said, no, we have 7 billion people stuck on this side. But depending on how you look at it, there's a issue of concern with the lift bridge because if for no other reason than because it's a single point of crossing. And so we've been looking at that. There's been a committee involved for about 5 or 6 years now that's been trying to plan out what would we do if there was an outage. And they looked at it in terms of kind of a stage, in a timeline of what would happen. So they start out with a short-term outage, which they define as, or we define as, about an hour or less. So what's the plan? So if we get a call from the bridge saying, we have a mechanical failure, put the plan into place. All the local agencies involved know what the plan is. So for an outage less than an hour, basically we're just going to divert traffic around the bridge so that it's not backing up on both sides. The reason for that is actually to make sure emergency vehicles can get through or repair vehicles can get through. We don't want all the streets on both sides blocked. So it seems like an inconvenience to just keep getting circled around, but the reason is really to make sure those roads stay open as much. So after a short-term outage, we go to a moderate-term outage, which is anywhere from more than an hour to 5 days, and that seems like a huge gap. But basically it's because nothing changes. We're going to continue to divert traffic away from the bridge. They'll put up signs that show where the detours are. Actually, the detours would be very similar to what we would do for a parade if you're in Houghton, or like the construction is now or was in Hancock, where it you had to go from Ripley, you had to go through Hancock to get across, so you'd divert that way or divert under the bridge, just again to keep traffic moving. The reason there's that delay up to 5 days is that gives us time to arrange to have the National Guard bring over a floating bridge called an improved ribbon bridge. And they can bring that over from the Sioux in about 5 days, 4 to 5 days. And so that's kind of where we're working on plans to get structures in place to make that bridge connect. And once that's in place, then we could transport supplies, and we would probably do things like shuttle buses across to get people back and forth. And then also we would do some rafting, and they did rafting practice here maybe 2 summers ago, I think. And that would be done here in town to move emergency vehicles across as needed. So after 5 days, then we're looking at more of a long-term response, so between 5 days and 2 months, and that's really where that improved ribbon bridge would come in. And the issue with that, there are a number of issues. The first one being it does take about 4 or 5 days to get here. The second part is it takes a lot of people to operate that, and the National Guard are citizens soldiers, so they are only available for so long. What we would do is after about 2 months, 2 months is about the time frame we would need to get a temporary fixed bridge in place. So there are some companies that make essentially modular bridges that they could bring in and set up, and we would be able to cross the span. Depending on what the issue was with the bridge, we might use part of the existing structure. You know, if it was just the center span that was damaged, maybe they could go right over the two other sides and make that work. If not, they could put it all the way across the portage. There are some other issues with that. It does require a center pier. They can't span the whole thing, so we would have to construct a pier out in the middle of the water. That's part of the reason it would take so long. We've been told by at least one company that they do carry enough parts in the U.S. I think they're in New York or Pennsylvania, but they do exist in their storage areas that they could ship them up here and put it together. So that's kind of the idea, is up to 2 months. The other downside is it closes the waterway until we come up with a replacement or can repair the lift bridge. So then that gets us to the kind of the that's the extended is 2 to 6 months, and then with the idea being we could get the lift bridge repaired within 6 months, depending on what the issue is. So, which is a big, you know, as you go further out in time, the possibilities get wider and wider. So it's a little bit harder to judge beyond that. But that would at least get things moving back and forth a little bit more. It certainly wouldn't be as convenient as what we have now, but it would be something.
And that lift bridge sees an immense amount of traffic. You wouldn't guess it for, you know, a place with a limited population, but you know, there aren't too many spans that see that much traffic going across it.
That is correct. Our estimates are between 22 and 25,000 crossings a day. And if I was curious the other day, and I was looking up, you know, what does the Mackinac Bridge see in a typical day? And during the peak summer season, it's higher than that. But if you look at, say, you know, the fall or the spring or whatever, their numbers are like half of that. So to put that in perspective, we have, on average, higher traffic than the Mackinac Bridge that goes across here. So it's heavily used, especially when you consider the size of the communities here. That's an awful lot. That's almost one per person per day. You know, that's a lot of traffic to deal with. So.
Sure. Oh, the temporary bridge, the floating bridge that would come up in case you have a slightly longer delay, would that be able to handle that kind of traffic, or would that only require, you know, like if you have to get across in emergency vehicles type thing?
We would probably try and restrict it a little bit to supply vehicles and emergency vehicles. And I think probably one of the first things we would do is do like shuttles, so school buses or maybe the transit buses that the cities have. So you would, for example, if you lived on the south side, you'd park like at the mall, get on a bus, and they would take you to the north side. And then so public transportation would be really an important component of this response. So that's kind of the idea. There is discussion about having, you know, people drive their own personal vehicles across, and in theory that could be done, but it would be – it's a slow crossing. It's not like driving across the lift bridge where you can go 25 miles an hour. It would probably be more like 5 or 10 miles an hour. And it's also condition dependent. So if we had high winds, for example, they'd have to take the bridge apart and store it on the shore temporarily. So it wouldn't be necessarily a 24/7 operation like we have. So it's not a good replacement, but it would definitely be able to get supplies and critical things across as we need to. So,
would we be doing any ferrying of, you know, either vehicles or people? Would that be in place, at least certainly at the beginning when people are stuck on the wrong side?
Yep, certainly at the beginning there is a plan to reunify people. So we're looking at especially things like school of choice students, you know, that would cross, or I know the ISD has students that come back and forth. Medical professionals that need to get back and forth to the hospital, that would be another component that that we are able to transport. But it would be a very limited system. I mean, we'd only be able to do, you know, a handful of people an hour, really, realistically. And then also patients, because both hospitals are on the north side of the bridge. So if they needed to be transported and couldn't go to Berga for some reason, we would need to transport them across by boat as well. So it would be very limited, but it can be done.
Now, with the temporary bridge solution, I'm sure you get asked a whole lot of times, how come we can't have a temporary bridge up here and ready to go, or maybe even just build a second bridge?
Well, those are both options. Financially, they're not real real easy options, maybe is the best way to put it. So the National Guard owns the floating bridge. They and they keep that in Sault Ste. Marie. And they have enough components. We've discussed in the past, they've discussed whether or not they could get more so we could span further or less. But that's an internal issue with the National Guard about what equipment they're able to have and how much of it they need to have. So that's some of it. It's possible to have some of these, like the temporary bridge, the fixed temporary bridge. But again, that's a lot of money to spend for something where the odds of it happening are pretty low. You know, that's certainly an option that the county could invest in, but you could argue that money could be better spent on things that we do need every day. But that's an option. Building a second bridge, I know, has been talked about up here for probably since they opened the canal, actually. But the costs are pretty high. You know, there's a discussion of everything from, you know, I read an article years ago about a bridge over in Chassel or south of Chassel by the south entry. And I read one about a suspension bridge from kind of where the Quincy Mine is all the way across up to, you know, the area by the mall. So wow. It'd be high enough for boats to go through. But, you know, you're talking hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion for a bridge like that. And I don't know if that's something the local community is really able to afford.
No, but I wouldn't think that the money would come from us. I mean, the original bridge wasn't charged to the counties here. So,
right. Okay. That is true.
All right. Well, let's hope this never happens, but if, you know, if people need to prepare it in case it does, and what steps that they make or steps that they should take to, you know, worst case scenario, so that we're ready, just like we prepare for other emergencies.
Yeah, so it's really not too different from what you would normally plan for. You know, have a plan in place with your family. So know how you're going to communicate, know where you're going to stay. If you work on one side and you live on the other, do you know somebody you could stay with for the night or for a couple nights if you need to? Or if your kids go to school on one side and you live on the other, is there somebody they could contact on that side? So having a plan in place for your family is a really good idea. Keeping fuel, so that we have limited resources on the north side, so it's a good idea really for any time to keep your fuel tank at least half full. One of the things we want to really avoid is people panicking. So if something happens to the bridge, don't run out and buy every scrap of food you can get. Don't run out and fill every gas tank you can find. We have supplies on each side that will last for a while, but it's a good idea just to keep your tank full. in the wintertime, in the summertime, this is another good reason to do that, or a good reminder to do that. Same thing with food. Keep a week's worth of food on hand. It might not be the best food in the world. You know, perishable food only lasts so long, but do you have enough stuff where if you need it to, you have a week's worth of food? That adds to the supplies we already have on both sides, so that's helpful. Making sure your workplace has a plan in place. And a lot already do for severe weather. So there are policies where can you get to work or not get to work? You know, whatever your workplace's policy is, you should be aware of that. And how is that going to change if we don't have access to the bridge or if you can't get across the bridge? So that's a good lunchtime discussion, if nothing else, with your coworkers. And then kind of the other piece of this is it's really helpful not to call 911 just to get information. If you have an emergency, absolutely call. You know, that's what they're there for. But we don't want to overwhelm them just asking questions like, when is the bridge going to open? Or is there something wrong with the bridge? Our suggestion is tune in to all the local media. That's where all that information is going to be put. Check Facebook. Excuse me. Check with your coworkers. I get a lot of messages from people in the community saying, "Hey, is there something going on with the bridge or something like that?" So tune in. We are gonna do our best to make sure all that information gets out as soon as possible. But those are some good preparedness things, really for any emergency, but especially the bridge. Know what you're gonna do.
I know 97.7 The Wolf is one of those stations that, you know, it's set up to deliver that information out, so I encourage people to tune in there. It doesn't hurt that we're one of our stations, but, you know, we want people, you know, what we'll be doing is doing our best to get out that information that you're talking about and making that readily available both on our, you know, Facebook page, keeping our report, and also on air as well. Does the county or your organization have any plans to utilize more technology to get that kind of information out?
Yeah, we're actually in the process, I would say, in the next let's just say by the end of the year, we're working on deploying a mass notification system. And if you have kids in school, a lot of schools already have something like this in place, but this would be kind of a countywide, both counties wide thing, that would be able to send out a message that you would be able to sign up for. So if you're I think our current plan is to import white pages into it. So if you're in the phone book and the white pages, that number would automatically be pulled in. And you can obviously opt out if you're not interested. But if you have a cell phone, you'd have to actually go online and sign up. And basically that would allow us to send voice messages or text messages, or it'll do emails. I think it'll do social media as well. We're still in the process of setting all of this up, but it would be something we'd be able to use to send out a message that said lift bridge is down, expected time to repair is this, if we know that information or whatever information we have. And that would not only apply to the lift bridge, but really any emergency in the county. And so the Region 8 Homeland Security Board, which is the group of all the emergency coordinators in the UP, gets a grant every year, and this money has been allocated from that grant to pay for the first 2 years for each county if they're interested, so, and the setup fee. So we're in the process of doing that. Some counties have this already, but it's in this area it will be a really useful tool to help get information out. We can also kind of subdivide information, so if there was an accident, for example, and traffic was blocked, we can basically put a pin on a map and it will send a message to say everybody within 10 miles of that spot. So it doesn't have to go to everybody in the county. You can kind of subdivide that, or if there was flooding, for example, you can send it just to one area that would be affected. There are a lot of neat features to it. It works very similar to the system. Actually, it is the same system that you probably get Amber Alerts on your phone at 2 o'clock in the morning from someplace. Same idea, only much more related to our area. But that's the same technology that it would use.
Well, of course, there are a lot of variables that go into play whether it's the bridge or other kind of weather emergency, the time of day, time of year, where you happen to be at the time. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to do your best to be prepared, is there a website that you can go that maybe has a checklist or some more information that can help you get ready for something like this?
There are a bunch of different ones. We have a kind of a rudimentary website for the county at the moment. We're working on updating that to include some of these things. We're also working on updating a number of years ago. There was a brochure that was sent out talking about the lift bridge in particular and important numbers to know if you had questions for either like medications or if you needed a shelter or something like that. They were all listed. And we're actually in the process right now of updating that. We're doing what we call a tabletop or a walkthrough of our lift bridge plan, outage plan. And when we're finished with this, it'll probably be another 2 months, we're going to update all of that information and send it out. So that's where we are with that. But yes, there are definitely a lot of preparedness information, kind of general information. The Red Cross has a lot of good preparedness stuff on their site as well, and they actually have a couple apps for their phone or for phones too that deal with everything from earthquakes to tornadoes to floods to how to do CPR to all of that stuff. So those are all good resources.
My guest has been Chris Van Arsdale. He is the Emergency Management Coordinator for Houghton County. Chris, very informative. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.